Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. We're going to step away from the election this week, which should be a nice break, and cover two big issues that were in the news. First, we're going to check in on the Affordable Care Act. There was a story this week as one of the nation's largest insurers, Aetna, pulled out of the ACA exchanges. And we'll talk to Keith Ruta of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee about that item. Another big story this week was the Department of Justice's announcement that it would phase out the use of private prisons, at least for prisoners held by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. That was announced on Thursday. Share prices of some of the larger companies plummeted. On Friday, one of the biggest, Geo Group, announced that the Federal Bureau of Prisons had actually extended one of its contracts for 2 years. So that's an odd quirk. I don't know how significant that is. Anyway, we'll talk about all of that with Christopher Petrella. He's an expert on the private prison industry. He's been on the show a couple of times in the past. First, I think I've mentioned how stressed out elections make me. Despite Hillary Clinton's healthy lead in the polls, and despite my confidence that she is likely to win, I keep stressing out, and I keep having these weird dreams. I've talked about this before. Last night, I tossed and turned all night. I dreamt that I was arguing with my father about the pharmaceutical industry, and the odd thing is that we were standing on a narrow ledge on the edge of a tall building in Mexico having this discussion about the pharmaceutical industry. I love to argue about things, but I am afraid of heights. So you can see that this was uncomfortable. Then I had this other dream where I was the only passenger on a private jet. Again, we have heights. And we were about to land in a foreign country with a strict government. And just then I realized that I was surrounded by illegal drugs. And I also had a very large bong. But there were no overhead bins or anything. So I was trying to figure out where to hide this giant bong. And customs agents boarded the plane just at that moment. I don't really remember the rest. Anyway, I want you to imagine for a moment how great the Donald Trump campaign would be if you could get into a time machine and visit the future and know for sure that he doesn't win. Like, how entertaining would it be to watch all of this if you knew his chances were zero instead of 15 or 20%? I mean, it would be incredibly entertaining. So we had another campaign shakeup this week. Each one, by the way, accompanied by backbiting and leaks to the press. I noted on Twitter that Trump's campaign is like House of Cards meets the Keystone Cops. He started with Corey Lewandowski, who promptly got into this power dispute and managed to edge out Roger Stone, the former Nixon dirty trickster, and also Trump's longtime aide, Sam Nunberg, who promptly attacked Lewandowski in the press. Then Corey turned out to be a total hothead. He assaulted a reporter and was replaced by Paul Manafort, one of the few campaign professionals in all of this. But last week, or the week before, reports emerged that Manafort had basically given up on the campaign and was just phoning it in. And then this week, it was alleged that he had lobbied and laundered money for the former Ukrainian government, which was very close to Russia. That reinforced the widespread perception that there's something hinky going on between Trump and Vladimir Putin. And now Manafort resigned. The campaign says he was forced to resign. And the billionaire head of Breitbart News, and I put news in quotes, of course, Steve Bannon takes over and immediately urges Trump to stop being so cautious and go on the offensive. He wants more right populism. So immediately, former Breitbarter started leaking to the press. The Daily Beast reported that Bannon liked to refer to Republican leaders as the C word, the very offensive C word. And then Kurt Bardella, a former Breitbart spokesman, told ABC that Bannon used to run these editorial meetings that, and I quote, sounded like a white supremacist rally. According to ABC, Bannon, quote, regularly disparaged minorities, women, and immigrants during daily editorial calls. So he should fit right in. And then Trump topped it all off by giving this rousing appeal to black voters in front of a mostly white audience in Michigan.
To those I say the following. What do you have to lose by trying something new like Trump? What do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose?
And then he predicted that he'd win 95% of the African-American vote. If only we knew this guy wouldn't win, it would be a laugh riot. Stay tuned, and we'll take a quick break and then be right back. Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and you know, there have been, oh God, a million false alarms with Obamacare. The sky is always falling, and that's because of, you know, Fox News, the conservative media. They always seize on any anecdote and predict that the whole scheme will come crashing down on us, and this happens every day. And I think those of us who are more reality-based understand that it's, first of all, extraordinarily challenging to get control over a healthcare sector that is as bloated as ours. And we understand that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, has plenty of warts. There's been stumbles and problems. And it has more warts than it would otherwise because of the unprecedented ideological obstruction that it faced, right? We can understand that. On the other hand, a recent study compared the health and well-being of poor people in a couple of states that chose to expand Medicaid coverage and refused to expand Medicaid coverage and found that low-income people were a lot healthier in states that expanded because, hey, imagine that access to healthcare actually helps you stay healthy. And for all its warts, there's no denying that there's been a dramatic decrease in the rate of uninsured Americans. Gallup tells us that healthcare insecurity, which is a measure of whether you've been unable to afford healthcare that you need in the last year, is at an all-time low as long as they've been measuring this. Anyway, amid all of the predictions of gloom, there was big healthcare news last week when Aetna, a giant insurer, announced that it was significantly decreasing its participation in the exchanges, right? And this is bad. This is going to reduce competition. It will send customers in 11 states scrambling for a new policy next year. Unless something happens, customers in 4 states will have only one insurer to choose from. So if you live somewhere with just like a single cable operator, you know how that works out. It doesn't work out well. So have the prophets of doom finally been proven correct? Or is something else going on here? Or maybe it's a little bit of both. Well, to help us sort this out, I'm joined now by Keith Ruda. Keith is the online director for PCCC, or PCCC. I think that has a good sound to it. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Keith, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hi, Josh. Glad to be here.
So, Keith, this first seemed to be one story, but then Jonathan Cohn and Jeffrey Young broke a big story for the Huffington Post that kind of changed the conversation to some degree. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we started out with, I think, the story that Aetna was going to be stopping. They were no longer going to sell coverage in these 11 state marketplaces. And as you just said, that is going to leave a large number of people with only one insurance option on the individual market. And in at least one county in Arizona, there are now no options available. And there are a huge percentage of people in the country who need individual insurance who have only maybe two or three options. The whole point of what the marketplaces were supposed to do was going to be to give people enough options that there was actual competition in the marketplace, and that would drive prices down, it would drive efficiency and things like that. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people don't have those choices, and therefore there's not a lot of competition happening in different places. Then this whole withdrawal of Aetna that was portrayed as not being able to make any money or not being able to make the margins that they wanted to make kind of got turned on its head with news of a letter that they had sent to the Obama administration earlier on this year dealing with the merger. They would like to merge with Humana, and apparently told the administration that if the administration challenged or blocked their merger with Humana, that they would indeed pull out of all of these marketplaces. Well, the administration did challenge that merger. They said that that would consolidate too much. It would reduce competition. It would harm consumers. And as a result, Aetna apparently made good on its threat, and they're pulling out of these marketplaces. So it's a little hard to know what exactly is driving what's their decision. But I think that it's pretty clear from the outside looking in that regardless of whether it's a question of margins or whether it's a political power play over this merger, I think what it really shows is that it's time to revisit the public option.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that in a moment. So this is, it's basic antitrust enforcement, right? The Justice Department said that if Aetna and Humana got together, a merger would hurt competition. It would ultimately cost consumers. And one thing that I find notable is that a lot of experts say that we have too little antitrust enforcement, right? That it's basically sure. It's too rare that a merger gets blocked. And when Aetna announced that it was pulling out, reporters asked if it had anything to do with the merger. The company kind of brushed off those questions. And now we know that they were really kind of brazen in articulating a threat like this in a letter to the Justice Department. Now, at the same time, we're progressives. We're supposed to be able to grasp nuance and hold multiple thoughts in our head at the same time, right? So Aetna's a corporate shark and boo on Aetna, but there are also real problems emerging in the ACA, right? Because I note that United Health also pulled out of the exchanges, also citing problems being able to turn a profit without jacking up premiums too high. They could not make it. They said that they could not make the margins work. So what is going on besides Aetna acting horribly? Because insurance companies acting horribly is like fish swimming, right?
I think I would agree with that. I think there are a couple of things. I think that they, in some areas of the country, they've found it more difficult to enroll healthy individuals into these programs than they thought. I don't know what the statistics are, but apparently there are people who are choosing to pay the extra fees and fines rather than go into what are turning out to be more expensive policies than I think anybody was expecting. And there are rural parts of the country that have always had trouble attracting insurance providers for individual coverage. Alaska, Arizona, where I am here in Kentucky, doesn't have that many providers. I've never had very many providers. We've always struggled with having competition in some of these parts of the country where you just have very low densities and high you know, base healthcare costs as a result. I think another issue that is driving costs on their side, which, you know, some of the other, you know, when you're dealing in the employer marketplace where they have more ability to raise prices, it probably affects their bottom line less. But, you know, we continue to see a lot of consolidation in the provider market in a lot of cities where you have hospitals, whole hospital networks, you know, where the, you know, a dominant provider has gobbled up all of the competition or almost all of it in those markets. Just as you would expect, when you reduce competition, the prices just skyrocket up. And then you've also got the issue of pharmaceuticals. You know, the pharmaceutical costs are out of control in this country. I think a lot of those things are driving an overall problem, and ultimately they're all going to need to be addressed.
And it's also possible that insurers kind of underpriced their products in the hope of getting people in, and now find that they have to ask for huge premium increases to make ends meet. But it's clear that, you know, there's these two problems for the consumer: too little competition, and also premiums are really going up too quickly, or going up very quickly, I should say. And it's clear that insurers underestimated the cost of the population that they were going to have to insure. But I would point out one thing that we don't know: if that mismatch, if these higher costs that we're seeing are a short-term response to pent-up demand. You had millions of people who had no health coverage, and a lot of them are saying, well, I can go to the doctor now for the first time. And there is, you know, I have a friend of mine who's an economist. He says, well, you know, we don't know whether this is going to be something that kind of smooths itself out in the next year or two or three, as people get to go to the doctor, as people get to get the treatment that they've been putting off. So as you say, there's a lot that we don't really know, and it is hard to model these things. It's hard to know who's going to be buying the products, who is not going to be buying the products. One thing that is, if you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio. I'm speaking to Keith Ruta from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. So one thing that's really clear here, Keith, is that by embracing a reform scheme based around private insurance insurers, you're going to be in bed with the insurance industry, and you don't have a lot of leverage over them, right? Because the administration would like a lot of insurers to be selling in all of these markets, and there's not that much that they can do to – there's nothing they can do to force them to sell in the marketplace if they don't want to. There's no consequences for insurers to skip the exchanges, right? Which brings us back to the public option that you mentioned. Keith, remind listeners what that is and help us understand how that might help fix this mess.
Sure. Well, I think your assessment is exactly right. Where when we're in bed with the private insurance market, there, you know, we don't have a lot of leverage. We can't force them to provide coverage that they don't want to provide. What their public option would do is it would create a government-run insurance option, you know, that people could. It would be on the insurance exchanges, just like the others. It would be regulated. It would it would have to live up to, you know, similar guidelines to the other policies. But by, you know, with the government providing it, it would definitely be there. There would always be one. So in some of these markets where there are no private options available anymore, there would be at least one provided by the government. In markets where they're down to one or two, there would be another. And even in markets, you know, like in some of the parts of the country, California, where you have a lot of places still interested in doing business there, you would have an option that has, you know, in my opinion, it would have a lot lower administrative overhead, a more beneficial cost structure internally, especially, you know, if it's built on, you know, Medicare's delivery system and the Medicare negotiating arrangements, that would be able to hold the other insurance companies kind of accountable, that it would be able to provide a level of competition that would really require them to be efficient in how they're setting up their networks and be competitive which is really what you're looking for in a functioning marketplace. If you want, you know, vibrant competition, and this would put that competition into the market in states even where it's not.
Now, in states where there already is a significant amount of competition, or in healthcare exchanges where there's a significant amount of competition, the insurers say, well, we can't compete against a nonprofit that has this massive purchasing power based on Medicare. What's the response to that? I mean, is this something that maybe should go into certain marketplaces but not others, or are we looking to ultimately force the insurance companies out?
That's a good question. I think it is a really open question about, you know, where this all eventually lands. You know, obviously, from an insurance company standpoint, they have no interest in having any competition. They would just assume there not be any. In markets where there is a lot of competition, you know, I think ultimately what would be great to see would be, you know, if, you know, a government-run program, you know, that's one way or another, more or less, you know, based on Medicare, taking advantage of some of those Medicare options, you know, it's not going to be a Cadillac program. It's going to probably provide the, you know, a basic level of coverage that people need in order to not be faced with going bankrupt.
Right.
And I think what you'd be looking for the private insurance companies to do would be looking at, you know, that as kind of a floor and saying, well, what can we add to this that is of value to people that people will want to pay, you know, pay for to take advantage of? I think that is very much what you would like to see in some of these markets.
Now, it's, we know in if we're realistic, that it's not likely that the Democrats will win back both the House and the Senate. And being a Democrat does not mean that you are necessarily a progressive. But do you think these problems are going to spark kind of new life into the debate over the public option? Because I ask because Hillary Clinton has said that she at least is open to adding. I don't know if she came out strongly in favor or said she was open to it. But is you know, as we see Aetna pull out, as we see these spikes in premiums, are we going to see a kind of a... Do you think we're going to see a rejuvenation of that debate?
Yeah, I think we definitely are. And I think what's happening here is you know, after the ACA was passed, then I think all of the oxygen was out of the room. It was such a bitter fight. It was so painful. It was hard to get passed. We got it passed. And I think there was no oxygen in the room left to talk about improving it, you know, fixing it, you know, looking at any, you know, issues that there were problems or anything. I think nobody just wanted to tackle it. Between the Democratic primary this year, where you had Bernie Sanders pushing for an actual single payer program, that certainly opened up a lot of space to start talking about this. Hillary Clinton has talked about certainly some of the problems that exist in healthcare today still. She has a lot of solutions that she proposes for fixing it. And she has said that, you know, that she will give Americans in every state in the country the choice of a public option insurance plan. So I think there's, you know, she's committed to that. And then I think when you have a situation that, you know, we didn't have right after, you know, right when this was implemented, where all of a sudden, you know, where we were expecting people would have a vibrant, competitive marketplace to choose plans from, you've got, you know, 25-30% of the country that has one choice. And now you've got some places that don't. You just are not seeing that competition. So, yeah, I think as we move further in this election, as we get closer to November, and then I think, you know, certainly during the next administration, we're going to have to be looking at how we take the next step.
Folks, you know, when Social Security was introduced, it had tiny benefits, absolutely tiny benefits. And in order to get it passed above the kind of obstructionists of the day, they had to exclude a lot of people. They had to exclude domestic and agricultural workers who were mostly people of color. And in subsequent years, they had to really improve upon it in order to make it the kind of popular program that we have today. And if you think about it, to this day, we're still fighting to improve the Social Security program. We're fighting, and the folks at PCC are certainly in the mix on this fight to expand benefits to stabilize its funding by lifting the payroll tax cap. Keith, what if we see the AACA as that was passed in 2009 as a starting point rather than an endpoint? What does that do to our perspective of the reform scheme?
Well, I think that's absolutely the way we need to look at it. And I think that is true of almost all government programs, not only looking at the idea of, you know, starting small and then building, but also just dealing with the ever-evolving economic realities that Americans are facing, the ever-evolving marketplaces and technology. The world changes quickly. Part of, you know, progressive is progress. You know, there's always progress happening, and I think we always need to be looking at these programs. But with the ACA, sure, there were a lot of political constraints put on us, and I think, as if we get into an era where we have fewer of those political constraints, we certainly want to look at how this can better serve Americans. And I think that, you know, what you're seeing in the presidential race for sure is, you know, a reality that, you know, a public option is enormously popular, despite what you would see necessarily inside the Washington, D.C. beltway.
Right.
It's very popular with people.
Yeah.
It's going to be very cost effective. It's going to help people a lot. We definitely need to be looking at that. And I think you're seeing an understanding in the political world that, you know, this is something that we should be talking about as we get closer to the election.
Yes. And one other point that I'd make before I let you go is that the Affordable Care Act has a provision that hasn't been discussed a lot. And it allows states starting next year in 2017 to take all those federal dollars and innovate and come up with their own healthcare schemes as long as they meet certain standards. Now, Vermont tried to make the numbers work for a single payer program. It could not. Colorado has a referendum. It may be the next state to try. California, a big state like California, may head that way in the near future. So, you know, we might end up with something that looks a lot more like Canadian style single payer, which isn't single payer. It's based in the provinces than we have today, at least starting in the blue states to begin with. Keith Ruta, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
It's been a pleasure, Josh. And we'll hopefully get a lot of support around the public option and be able to really improve healthcare for Americans, even beyond the gains that we've made over the last 10 years, over the next 10.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Christopher Petrella to talk about the private prison industry. Big news this week on that front.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. But there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. Thank you. line, far from Folsom Prison. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Christopher Petrella. Chris is a lecturer of American Cultural Studies at Bates College. Chris Petrella, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, we've had Chris on the show a couple of times to discuss his research into the private prison industry. At the time, he was a lowly grad student at UC Berkeley. So I want to begin by congratulating you on the new gig. Congratulations, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Or maybe I should offer condolences for going into adjunct hell. I don't know. One of the two.
I'm a lucky guy. It's not an adjunct position, so I feel thankful about that.
Okay, then congratulations pertain. Anyway, a big announcement this week. The Department of Justice said that it was phasing out the use of private prisons. It's a big deal in that it was based on an Inspector General's report that makes what many of us have been saying for years official, right? Private companies are bad at running prisons, and by and large, the promises that they made have not come to fruition. More often, these deals have ended in disasters of varying degrees. I think we should also put this in perspective. There are around 130,000 prisoners in privately operated facilities, and 23,000 are held by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. So this is a slice of that larger population. This announcement doesn't mean anything for the rest, per se, who are either in state facilities or held by Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. The federal government prosecutes more people for immigration-related offenses than all other violations combined. This is a little fun fact. Now, Chris, you seemed pretty skeptical about the meaning of all this on Twitter. You mentioned that we're just switching people from one cage to another. What's your view here?
I think that's a pretty accurate characterization of my claims, Josh. I was certainly pleased with the announcement. I've dedicated the last 10 years to working toward the eradication of the for-profit containment model. So no one's happier than me about this thing. At the same time, I do think it's important to take a moment to pause critically about what this actually mean. So I am skeptical. As you already stated, Yates's memo essentially calls for the prospective relocation of about 23,000 prisoners. And that's a figure that represents around 1% of all U.S. prisoners. And it's a relocation from quote unquote private facilities to quote unquote public facilities. So for those of us who are who place a premium on population reduction policies, this is not that. This is more or less a realignment policy.
I agree with that, but I do want to just say, I think it is a big deal. First of all, I think it's a pretty big deal because of the IG's report itself. Would you not expect opponents of privatization to kind of get new ammunition from this? Like I would expect to see other dominoes fall.
I'm not quite sure. I think my hope is that will certainly be the case. But a number of agencies have come out and been very clear, at least over the past couple of days, and saying, for instance, that ICE will not be affected by this policy directive. It's yet to be seen whether municipalities and states will also try to scale down their use of contract facilities, but in some senses we have been here before, and if history is a guide, companies like CCA and GEO, but particularly CCA, are quite adept at finding strategies for rebounding from these types of downfalls. I'm sure we'll chat about this in a little bit, but just to preface,
I'm going to get back to that.
Oh, please, perfect.
So, okay, I think you're right. They have proven adept at adapting to these things, but I just want to point out that, not all cages are equal, and I think we need to focus on reducing mass incarceration. At the same time, those who are in prison should have access to halfway decent health care, halfway decent nutrition, halfway decent. And I'm not even saying it's decent, you know, rehabilitation services, and be less likely to be assaulted. And all of those things are inferior in private facilities, according to the IG's report, according to your research, according to a lot of previous research. And the other point that I'd make is that this is an industry that, as we're going to discuss, has a lot of lobbying clout, and it can't hurt that they lost, like, I don't know, 40% of their stock value in a day. But fair enough. I wanted to have you on to give us a big picture of this industry's history, because a lot of people are saying this is going to be its death knell. And as you mentioned, it has shown a great ability to adapt. I don't think that's true. I think history suggests that it's been nimble and able to adapt to changing political winds. Chris, when and how did we start privatizing prisons?
Well, we started, in the United States at least, a variety of smaller companies, now defunct, began incursions into the quote-unquote, you know, for-profit prison market in the very, very late 70s, 78, 79. One of the first firms on the scene was Behavioral Systems Southwest. They're no longer around. There were a couple of others that developed around that time that are also no longer around, but CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, seems to be a pretty familiar name these days in political circles. They developed in 1983, and you know, I think this is a good seg, because they first broke ground on their inaugural facility in late 83 in Houston, Texas, under contract with the Immigration and Naturalization Services, right, the INS, which no longer exists by those terms. And the project was called the Houston Processing Center. It was a minimum security 300-bed institution for the short-term confinement of quote-unquote illegal aliens. I'm using CCA's language from 1983 here. And at the time, cost about $4.5 billion to build and operate. Now, I mention this because I think it's important that the INS was the first government agency, right, state or federal, to contract with CCA. The relationship between the INS and CCA is important because it demonstrates the way that these pathways among race, ethnicity, citizenship, containment, and profitability kind of get worked out, right? And so a more straightforward way to articulate that is to say that CCA was able to privatize an immigrant detention facility, more or less, and use Mexican and Central American immigrants as test subjects in an experiment of privatization without facing, you know, legitimate, large-scale, widespread public backlash. Right, and I think that's important to ask questions about which communities are we using to experiment on new carceral technologies, policies, etc.
Well, that is a very interesting point. So when they started there, but at some point in the, I think in the 90s, right? They started moving into, at the state level, they started moving into state. It became kind of a trend. Wasn't it part of this kind of, like, you know, Bill Clinton came in, he said the era of big government was over. There was a kind of a broader push toward privatization of public services, right?
That's exactly right. Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, CCA in particular really made incursions on the federal level, inroads on the federal level in kind of 93, 94, when it won its first major contract with the BOP. And you're right, in the fall of 93, White House officials kind of found themselves caught between two political objectives, the first being putting more people in prison, and the second being reducing the size of the federal government, right? So that grew out of a promise that Bill Clinton made during his campaign when he adopted Perot's popular theme of small government and promised to reduce spending in the Beltway. But what I'd also like to add is that about 10 years earlier, right, CCA tried to court contracts and favor with the BOP, and then director of the BOP in 1985, Norm Carlson, went on record saying that he had major, major reservations about the idea of contract prisons. And in fact, in a congressional privatization commission, he said, quote, "I am somewhat skeptical of the private sector's involvement in corrections. I certainly have not made a firm decision, but I am not one who's going to get on the bandwagon and say that the private sector can solve all of our problems overnight." Now, I should say that Norm Carlson today is currently the director emeritus of the GEO Group's board, right? I mean, you can't make this, you know, I wish I weren't
That's an unbelievable. First of all, excellent.
Thank
tidbit.
You. It's a grotesquery.
Yeah, excellent grotesque.
Thanks.
What the hell, man?
Jesus I know. Man, I don't even. Okay. I know. It's yeah.
It's crazy. All right. So I'm going to skip forward a little bit. These companies or this industry, this entire industry, got into trouble not at the federal level. They got into trouble when it became kind of a rage at the state level. They thought that they'd have this booming market. They built a bunch of prisons. They overbuilt. And then the crappy services started to show. There were a couple of high-profile riots. And in the late 90s and like around 2000, it looked like the prison industry, the private prison industry, might have overextended itself to the point where it was on a brink of collapse. Now, let me just throw out a couple of numbers. In January of 1998, CCA shares were selling for $70. 70 bucks a pop, right? 3 years later, January of 2001, they were selling for $1.15 a share. That's an interesting tidbit too, right? So that's January of 2001. What happens 8 months later? 9/11. What happened then, Chris?
Well, I should also say that in December of 2000, if my memory serves me correctly, CCA stock actually bottomed out at 18 cents a share, which is what gives me some skepticism about all of the reporting and sort of journalistic bacchanalia yesterday. CCA.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to highlight it. Yeah, because everybody was talking about how, I don't know what it ended up being. Did they lose 50% of their market value? But I this is why I brought.
Yeah,
this up.
Somewhere between 40% and 50% of their market value. And yeah, you're right. I mean, just to underscore, you know, CCA began speculating on prisons and built these prisons without them being filled or without even having contracts. And then B. CCA tried to reorganize itself in a variety of ways for tax purposes in the late 90s, early 2000s, and that created sort of an internal disaster where shareholders were really pissed off about the way the company was being run. Half of it was private, half of it was publicly traded, and so they basically forced the company to convert back to a public company called CCA.
But this way, let me interrupt you briefly. So we're talking about CCA, but it wasn't just
That's
CCA.
Correct.
GEO Group, same with GEO Group, same with Wackenhut, same with the other smaller firms. So this was industry-wide. If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I am talking to Christopher Petrella of Bates College. Chris, 9/11, how did that change the picture?
Yeah, I mean, this is 9/11 in a lot of ways was used as a pretext to grow the budget for the Department of Homeland Security. And as you know, the Department of Homeland Security Appropriations Committee and Subcommittee today is now responsible for you know, codifying what's known as the ICE immigrant detention nomenclature.
So they now, you mentioned that they started with immigration detention, but at this point, that rapidly expands, right? In the aftermath of 9/11, we're suddenly locking up a lot more migrants than we had been before 9/11, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And the growth rate for DHS / ICE facilities. Actually, / U.S. Marshal Service facilities from 9/11 through about 2005 or so was significant. But it wasn't really until the mid to late 2000s that ICE beds began getting filled to the capacity that they currently are.
So this move into immigration detention, even if it took 6, 7, 8 years, it saves the day to some degree, right? Their stock prices rebound. These companies start reporting really robust growth, really stable revenues, et cetera, et cetera. To what degree was this the result of the overall spike in security paranoia? And to what degree was it, or whatever you want to call it, I you know what I'm talking about, and how much of it was due to lobbying pressure? Because there was an outcry of panic, right, that was unrelated to their lobbying. There were political things going on at the same time as they went very aggressively into this
market. Right. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways those two sort of political fields are, you know, inseparable from one another, because you're right. I mean, clearly lobbying doesn't occur in a political vacuum, and the political milieu has to be the case at the time was such that you know, government agencies were very amenable to taking these dollars and then offering contracts. So between 2004 and last year, CCA spent about $18 million, and the GEO Group spent around $4 to $5 million on lobbying for more beds. In specific, CCA spent about $9 million, and the GEO Group spent about $1.5 million lobbying Congress specifically on Homeland Security appropriations.
All right, Chris. Now, there's a point to these questions, right? You saw this huge drop in stock prices on Thursday, as we've talked about. We've talked about how this industry has proven to be nimble and resilient and has shown that it can use its lobbying ability to find new profit centers as the kind of corrections landscape changes. So now we're seeing incarceration reform gain greater traction than it has in the past. So I'm not just talking about the DOJ announcement. We're starting to see Republicans getting on board with the need to reduce the prison population. They have different, they're coming at it from a different angle. For them, it's a cost issue in many ways. Where is the industry going now that they can see the writing on the wall?
Yeah, that's a very perceptive observation in my view. GEO and CCA together have really pivoted in recent years to diversify their services that don't necessarily involve locking people up behind bars in the sort of traditional, you know, long-term secure confinement facility or a detention facility. So they're both they've invested very aggressively over the last 5 to 6 years in, you know, prisoner rehabilitation services, and I use quotes there. In 2011, for instance, GEO acquired this company called BI, Behavioral Interventions, which is one of the world's leading producers of monitoring equipment for people awaiting trial or serving parole or probation sentences. A couple of years before that, in 2009, GEO purchased Just Care, which is a medical and mental health provider. CCA is doing the same thing. In 2013, it acquired Correctional Alternatives, which is a company that provides housing and rehabilitation services, residential reentry programs, and home confinement. And they, you know, they bought them for about $35 million. So these companies know exactly what they're doing. They're agile. They follow market trends. And they know where growth industries, they know where growth industries are. There was even evidence back in some of CCA and GEO's annual reports from the early and mid 2000s that they, you know, they very much anticipated that ICE and immigrant detention was really going to be the next quote unquote growth market, and they could expect higher. This is what's key. They could expect higher operating margins, higher profit margins operating those facilities as opposed to the traditional prison facility model. So they know, you know, they know exactly what they're doing. They are quite savvy.
Why is that? Is that because immigrants tend to be a younger population?
Younger population, generally healthier. There's some sort of incipient data coming out right now that suggests that's the case. It needs a closer look. My sense is it has to do with the length of containment, right? The length of stay. The shorter the terms are, the less one would be expected to provide, right? By way of legal services, by way of law libraries, by way of medical care, staffing, et cetera.
Okay. So, all right, the industry is moving into sentencing alternatives, buying up rehab centers and halfway houses, moving into the parole is becoming privatized. Are they adopting the language reformers use?
yes. I think this is... I think this is generally the ideology of conservatism, right? You co-opt progressive and/or reformist movements, and then you pervert it toward your own ends, right? And I mean, this is just the traditional sort of political dialectic. There's a mixture of progressive and conservative elements. You extract the language of one to meet the needs of the other.
Do you have any examples of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a perfect example of this is just the Right on Crime initiative, right? And the bipartisan support we have now for quote unquote rehabilitative services. I mean, you look at, you know, here, I'll actually provide a more striking example. So if you look at the DOJ's memo the other day. I don't have it in front of me at the time, but the language read something like private prisons served their purpose at the time that we went into contract with them in the early 90s. We've since discovered that they don't provide services as cost effectively as public prisons, and our main concern is security and safety and rehabilitation, right? That's, in my view, that's the purest of pure ideology. There's very little evidence to suggest that private prisons or public prisons are particularly concerned about rehabilitation when, you know, the majority of prisons in California are publicly operated, yet the recidivism rate is between 60% and 70%.
And there's some really, really solid data showing that education, which is we offer terrible education services to people in prison. But when we do offer education services, it significantly reduces recidivism and actually saves a lot of money in the long run.
That's
so
right.
Let me ask you this. We know what the problems with private prisons are. We know it. We've seen it. We've been through all of this. What do you see as the risks as these companies move into alternatives to incarceration? Are we going to see similar kind of like cost-cutting issues? What is that going to look like?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think anything that that could potentially attenuate the bottom line is going to be avoided. So that means, you know, staffing costs. That means providing benefits to employees. It means cutting corners. I mean, my personal... I'm personally fascinated by how CCA and GEO Group, as they move into alternative sentencing technologies, policies, protocols, is going to retain or are going to retain their real estate investment trust status with the IRS. So, right, as you know, both of these companies for tax purposes are classified as real estate investment trusts or REITs with the IRS. One of the criteria that these companies have to meet in order to qualify as a REIT is you have to have most of your holdings locked up basically in real estate, right? And pun fully intended. As a result, It reduces the corporate tax liability of these companies to zero. But I wonder, as they start to sort of migrate sort of horizontally into other investment areas, whether or not they'll be able to retain that status. Because if they can't, then it's going to dramatically increase their corporate tax liability. And that's something that they and their shareholders will have to contend with.
Oh, Chris, they'll figure out a way to avoid paying taxes. Come on, Chris.
We'll see what happens. Well, the reason I mention it, and you're right, of course, right? But the reason I mention it is because they spent a couple of years chatting with the IRS about what this conversion might look like. So, they will have to come up with something, and I'm not exactly sure what that. What that'll be.
Maybe I'll have to have David K. Johnston on to talk about how these companies will move forward without paying taxes. We're almost out of time. Let me ask you a final big picture question.
And
you're going to have about 2 minutes to answer it, or a minute and a half to answer it. A final big picture question. Moving people from one cage to another is not enough. What should the focus of reducing the number of people we throw behind bars be? Is it enough to get rid of mandatory minimums and stop imprisoning nonviolent drug offenders? Or is there a more fundamental dynamic in the way we approach crime and punishment that we need to think about?
Very much the latter, right? These questions of punishment, of criminality, of criminalization are all very much bound up in larger questions about the type of society we want to create, and more specifically, the sort of people, bodies, political agents that actually count by society as viable political subjects. And by that, I very, very simply mean, in the context of the United States, which types of people are deserving of social protections, right? Which types of people are given the benefit of the doubt, right? Which sorts of people and which types of people are policed at disproportionate rates, right? Who has access to high-quality defense attorneys, right? You think about something as fundamental as the court system, right, which in prison activist circles, I don't think gets enough airtime. But the New York Times, and I know the New Yorker just a couple of days ago, has been covering this trend over the last 30 or 40 years where the vast majority of criminal cases just never make it to court, right, which in a lot of ways is actually a constitutional violation. So I'd like to see equal access under the law. I'd like to see all citizens and non-citizens counted as equal under the law and being given the protections afforded to them under a robust democratic system.
Christopher Petrella, we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week.
Thanks, Josh. I appreciate it.
Folks, Chris has a piece coming out next week. He's not sure where it'll be published. You can follow him on Twitter and you'll catch it. He is at CF Petrella, PETRELLA. I'd also like to thank Keith Ruda from the PCCC. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, HOL, and you can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can and should subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud, or wherever else you can find it. I would also like to thank Digby for letting me host the show at Hullabaloo, and Crooks and Liars for letting me hang out at their joint. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, and the major.